Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. This week, millions of Americans are tuning in to the Ken Burns documentary, The War. It's a documentary about World War II. It's much anticipated. I saw the first 2.5 or 3 hours of it last night, along with millions of other Americans. And it has led to a lot of conversation in America today, a lot of expectation. You know, in the bookstores, you see a lot of World War II displays, books, DVDs, movies, documentaries, and also academic discussion at the same time about the meaning of World War II. Today, we're going to be asking the question, why are Americans so fascinated with World War II? An interesting topic for our conversation. Why are we so fascinated with World War II? What happened in that war that continues to define us today to the point that just about everything we know about war, geopolitics, and all the rest comes back to those American years between 1941 and 1945, when we fought that last good war, as many people have called it. I don't think that's the appropriate way to phrase it, but that war in which Americans were completely united, a war against multiple foes, a war that continues to define America even now. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're going to be talking about why Americans are still so fascinated with World War II. The number is 877-893-TALK, 877-893-8255. We'll get to that in just a moment. But speaking about threats, and even as talking about World War II, you have to talk about the leaders that really were threatening world stability at the time. Iranian President Ahmadinejad came to the United States, to New York, to speak at the United Nations, but far more notoriously spoke at an event planned at Columbia University today. Now, as he got up to speak, he was introduced by Columbia President Lee Bollinger, who identified him in the introduction as being petty and cruel. Now, afterwards, the Iranian president said that he felt he'd been mistreated there at Columbia by the president and perhaps even by the students. There will be a lot of conversation about this, but I want to tell you that I think it was a huge mistake, an egregious error of judgment for the president of Columbia University to give the Iranian president a forum. You know, you will hear from time to time, when it's convenient, academic institutions say that they are a place of absolutely open discussion. Well, don't buy that for a moment. The academic environment is a place for many discussions, but no place genuinely offers the opportunity for unlimited free expression or the expression and debate of unlimited ideas. Every single institution, every single organization brackets some issues as unthinkable, as undebatable. And you would think that one that denies the very existence of the Holocaust, the historical occurrence of the Holocaust, one who has said that his ambition is to destroy Israel and to push the Jews into the sea, would not find on an American university campus a free place for the exchange of those ideas. I do not think it is enough, not by a long shot, for the president of the university to say we're doing this in the name of academic freedom. You just have to wonder, where would that go? Where would that end? Does that mean that you would have anyone, no matter how evil, no matter how public in his intentions to do evil, on your campus? Are we really at the point that there are all ideas that we're going to suggest that this should be open for consideration? I'm going to come back to the fact that that's not even the case in this case. In other words, the president of Columbia would not be saying that that any idea would have the right to be established. Just think of what happened at Harvard University when Lawrence Summers, the president there, made some very, very innocuous remarks concerning women in science. He was hounded out of office. But now you have the president of Columbia, another Ivy League institution, that invited the Iranian president, Ahmadinejad, in. Now, you'll be hearing a lot of discussion about what the Iranian president had to say, and all of us will be looking closer at what he had to say. But nothing he said during the course of his speech at Columbia University in any way mitigated the plans and intentions that he has already stated for the Iranian people. He was defiant at the United Nations and defiant in a press conference held earlier today when it came to Iran's nuclear program And there is no reason to believe that this visit to the United States has done anything to lessen global tensions over the nation of Iran. Looking at other issues, of course, on the international scene, the coming break in the Anglican Communion is something that all of us are watching, even as the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, went to New Orleans at the end of last week in an effort to try to persuade, or apparently to try to persuade, the American Church, at least as represented by the bishops of the Episcopal Church USA, to meet the directives of the Anglican Communion. Two basic points here: to cease and desist from the election and consecration of future openly gay bishops, and to refrain from blessings of same-sex ceremonies. Now, you have a report coming out from the Telegraph, one of Britain's major papers, that says that the Anglican Church could split by the end of the year. It is expected that the American Church will respond in the negative to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and indeed will turn down the directives. This is what you now read from Jonathan Petrie, the religion correspondent, writing from New Orleans today. He writes, "The worldwide Anglican Church is expected to split radically by the end of the year under plans being drawn up by a leading conservative archbishop to adopt a breakaway group of American dioceses," the Daily Telegraph has learned. "Under the unprecedented proposals, the archbishop would allow the conservative diocese to opt out of the liberal American branch of the Anglican Church and affiliate with his province thousands of miles away." Now, that in itself is very interesting, and we'll be watching how this story unfolds, even as we've been watching over recent days. It is a very sad spectacle to see the consternation of a church that has for years tolerated unbiblical practices and has now moved into a position where it's refusing correction from the larger Anglican Communion. Great Britain made the news in recent weeks for approving, through its Human Embryology and Fertilization Authority, the creation of human-animal hybrid eggs, human-animal hybrid embryos, that is. And now the New York Times is calling for the same thing. And it's very interesting to see the reason why. This is from today's New York Times, an editorial entitled "Of Animal Eggs and Human Embryos." Listen to this. "A respected team of stem cell researchers at Harvard spent nearly $100,000 over the course of a year advertising for egg donors. Hundreds of qualified women were interested enough to call, but having heard what was entailed, not one was willing to donate eggs. Many were likely deterred by the time, effort, and pain required." Now, this is an interesting story. The last sentence of their first paragraph said, "There are distressingly few women willing to donate their eggs for experiments at the frontiers of this promising science." So it's very interesting. You'll hear an awful lot of people say that it's President Bush's strictures on stem cell research that is putting a damper on this kind of scientific work. And now you have an admission from Harvard University, now transported and communicated through the New York Times, telling us that it is also due to the fact that there are few women who are willing to donate their eggs. Now listen to this. "With few human eggs available, some privately financed stem cell scientists are studying animal eggs to see if they can work the same magic when injected with a human nucleus." Now, again, what do you have there? You would have an animal egg and a human nucleus. You would have a hybrid creation. The Greek word for that is chimera. You would have this very, very scary, almost science fiction-like creation in which you would be merging and putting together, combining DNA, genetic material, from an animal species and from a human being. The question is not where would that begin. The obvious question is where would that end? And what you'll hear from a lot of these scientists is, well, you don't need to go there because none of us would do anything that would actually create a human-animal hybrid as a living species. Well, or a living animal. Well, just remember, we've heard that before. And every time we are told that science won't go there, science seems to find its way there, and actually fairly quickly. Now, in the United States, there are proposals that there be the creation of these hybrids where there would be even some human brain material inserted into the animal creation with some cognitive abilities. Now, that ought to scare us to death. And it says something that now there is an editorial in today's edition of the New York Times indicating the very same thing. Meanwhile, in Great Britain, where it appears that many of these things are moving ahead more quickly than elsewhere, we are also told that a major advance in fertility treatment is being announced by some doctors as they are announcing a technique that would allow human eggs to be grown in the laboratory from ovarian tissue taken from a woman. Now, here's how the Telegraph explains it. It said it would allow career women or those waiting to meet the right partner to delay motherhood for years. One of the scientists behind this described it as an exciting development. Well, here's what it is. It's a false promise. On this program, we've looked at the scientific data indicating that women over age 40 have a much harder time, carrying a baby in a healthy way, full term, than younger women. It turns out that their eggs also age more quickly than the scientists had predicted. It turns out that these fertility treatments intended to tell women they can have it all and just delay motherhood aren't delivering on their promises. There's no reason to believe that this will be any different. It's another effort by scientists to try to move into a new reproductive future in which we redefine what it means to be human and redefine the entire human lifespan. That obviously has its limits. Back to talk about what makes us so fascinated about World War II. I'm Albert Moeller. Welcome back to the Albert Moeller Program. Ken Burns said he was reluctant to do a documentary on World War II after he had done so many years ago his big documentary on the Civil War because he didn't want to just focus on war. And yet, it seemed that World War II is a narrative that simply demands to be told. I think there's another reason why the story needs to be told and needs to be told now. We're living in a time when veterans of World War II are dying at an approximate rate of 1,000 per day. That's right. Every day in America, approximately 1,000 of the roughly 4 million men and women in uniform, mostly men, of course, are dying. 1,000 a day. That means 7,000 funerals a week. Now, obviously, we are at one of those generational turning points. And before long, it will be true in at least 20 years or so that meeting a veteran of World War II will be something like just in recent times meeting a veteran of World War I. There is a wisdom there that is lost. There are stories there that need to be told. And yet, when it comes to World War II, even far more than World War I, even at the time, there is the sense that this was the great moral cataclysm of the age, the great battle, war, worldwide conflagration of the age. There is a fascination with World War II. You can see this. If you go into the bookstore, you'll see an awful lot of military history, and majority of that is World War II. You look at the movies that were made. You look at the stories that are told. You look at the names and the careers that were made during World War II. And then you look at how America was transformed during that period, and you recognize that there's no way to explain who we are as a nation today without recourse to talk about the Second World War. We also know that the Second World War presented us in both the Pacific and in the European theaters with a very clear understanding that the war had to be fought. And there was very little moral relativism, let's just put it that way, in this war. There was a clear sense that there was a right side and a wrong side to history. Now, history is always complex. The reality is that when we look back at World War II, we do see what almost every single morally sensitive human being would have to state as adequate cause for war. Even those who might tend towards pacifism or some kind of non-military response in almost any other setting will recognize that when it comes to World War II, there was no question. Now, we can have all kinds of debates about what comes afterward. You would think that the people who understood that war was necessary then would understand that war is likely to be necessary in so many other contexts as well. But today I want us to talk about why we are so fascinated with World War II. What is it about that war? What is it about that story that is still so compelling? Why is it that millions of Americans are watching hours and hours of narrative this week about World War II? Some of you may have seen the first night's installment of The War by Ken Burns. I'd love to know what you think about it. I was particularly struck last night by the personal way he went at the story from four towns, four very different places in America, tracing people through their experience of the war. And last night, the most moving part for me was the Battle of Guadalcanal. And some of you, maybe even listening today, were there. I'd love to hear from you. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. This is the Albert Moeller Program, the place for intelligent Christian conversation. And while an awful lot of people are interested in World War II who aren't Christians, we as Christians have a particular interest in this war. It changed so much of America. It became a great engine for social change. It also changed the missionary landscape. The war led to big changes in the world picture. It was the catalyst for the end of colonialism. It was the cause of the opening of many parts of the world to influences. It also, at the end of the war, became the story of the Cold War. As Winston Churchill would say, an iron curtain has descended upon Europe. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. What made World War II so different? What made that war such a focal point in our imagination? Let's talk about the moral dimensions of that war. What was it about that war that is such a fascination for Americans today? The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I had my 15-year-old son, Christopher, watch with me last night. And as I was watching him watch the Ken Burns first installment of the war, I recognized that that war took place so long before he was born that to him that must look somewhat like the Revolutionary War, just people wearing more recognizable clothes. I also recognize that he has come into a world in which World War II is simply an early chapter explaining why the world is as it is. I wanted him to see that story, and last night I particularly wanted my son to see that boys just slightly older than he were very quickly, during this cataclysm, finding their way into uniform, onto submarines, into the cockpits of fighters all over the world. And I thought last night one of the best parts of the Ken Burns documentary was showing the tremendous heroism and courage of the average GI, the average American soldier, especially there at Guadalcanal, where they were affected by so many different things. They appeared to have been abandoned. They didn't know the situation. I mean, it's just hard for us to imagine fighting a war. Our wars are now broadcast on CNN. What would it be like to have a war in which the people on the ground really didn't have a clue, in many cases, what was going on? They just knew that they had dysentery and were in a hot, muggy, dangerous jungle being shot at with their comrades being blown apart. They did know that. The phone number is 877-893-8255. James is calling from Louisville, Kentucky. Go ahead, James.
Yes, Ivor Mahler. I just wanted to say I think the reason we're so fascinated with the war is simply because we can actually define the good and the evil and true heroes in the war. And I think we Americans really pull for, you know, the good guy, so to speak. And we just get caught up in the sacrifices and the act of heroism in it.
Now, James, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what was the great evil we were fighting? How would you define that?
Definitely one of the great evils. Being a Christian, I would have to say evolution and then Nazism and imperialism.
Yeah, you certainly had the ambitions of Hitler very clear by the time America entered the war. You know, one of the things that has also come to light is the fact that many Americans don't know a whole lot about history. For instance, we did not declare war on Germany. Germany declared war on us. Of course, people know that we were surprised by the attack upon Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941, and know that the next day, the President of the United States, Franklin Roosevelt, called for a declaration of war against Japan. But it was just about 4 days later that Adolf Hitler declared war on the United States. And so it was inevitable that it would be a two-front, two-theater war. But the actual way it happened was itself very, very interesting. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. One of the reasons why I think it was so important that Ken Burns do this documentary now, and certainly there are things to complain about in any documentary, especially of this magnitude and scale. We would all tell the story somewhat differently, perhaps, if we were the director. But he does have an incredible gift. And I think the genius of the way Ken Burns tells a story is that he goes and finds people who were there and traces their experience. You know, you're talking to boys from Laverne, Minnesota, and Mobile, Alabama, and from Watertown, Connecticut. And you're watching them as they instantly grow into manhood in jungles, on the battlefield, in some of the places where I, as a dad right now, can't imagine that my son could so quickly be. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. Why World War II matters. That's our topic. We'll be right back with your calls.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The question is this: why are we so fascinated with World War II? I had lunch today with one of my good friends who was a brave veteran of the Vietnam War. And, you know, I think one of the big differences there is not the heroism of the men on the ground. It's not the courage of the soldiers. It was the mobilization of the nation. It was the fact that there was no great national movement, no great national cause that was understood connected with the Vietnam War. And for that reason, the nation's failure, and I do want to put it that way, the nation's failure to understand what is at stake and was at stake in the Vietnam conflict, and to have a united front on this inevitably meant that that was a different experience for America. The Korean War wasn't even called that. It was called the Korean Conflict. Things have become far more complicated in a post-World War II world. But that war, well, it was complicated, but it wasn't complicated in terms of the mentality of folks who knew that the war had to be fought. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. We're talking about this today because of the Ken Burns documentary. The war began last night and continues in coming days on your local PBS station. Let's go to Mel calling from Dodge City, Kansas. Go ahead, Mel.
Well, what really brought the people together for World War II? I mean, that's the reason, part of the reason these folks now are so involved with it and want to know as much as they can, because World War II brought the nation together. Everybody was involved, from Victory Gardens to the automobile industry and the shipping industry, changing over and building arms, building tanks, building airplanes, to, you know, small places that were, you know, putting in their tires, getting rubber, doing all this everything. Everybody was involved with it somehow, and it made it a country's war and not just a military's war.
Mel, that's a very good point. You know, my parents were children during World War II. I guess by the time the war ended, they were about nine. And both of them can remember what it was like to have everything rationed and to have the lights turned out at night, to have a dad that went to work on Navy ships during the day, couldn't talk about it, to have, you know, a sister that was involved in tending to those who needed medical care. They were down in Florida at the time, which was a major place for mobilization. By the way, one of the points that was made in the Ken Burns documentary last night was that America was so complacent at the beginning of World War II that we lost hundreds of ships along the Atlantic seaboard from Nazi U-boat attacks because America just wasn't prepared. And a lot of mayors kept the lights on seacoast cities because they thought it would be demoralizing and might hurt tourism if they turned the lights off at night. They had to get over that pretty quickly. But nonetheless, I remember one of the stories my mom told as a little girl was how that they didn't have butter because of rationing, and so they would have margarine that would come in blocks, and they would have to put yellow food coloring in it to make it look yellow, to look like butter. You know, that's certainly a contrast, I think, with the war being fought right now. Most Americans don't feel that they're very much a part of this. Mel, I want to come back to you a minute, calling again from Dodge City, Kansas. I want to ask, did you see the Ken Burns documentary last night?
Yes, sir, I did.
Okay, give me your quick review of it.
Well, I think overall, they're, you know, from what I've seen so far, they've done an excellent job, because I'm an avid World War II buff. I'm a 15-year Navy vet back in the 70s and 80s, and I think they're going to be able to put together a real good show and inform the folks really what happened during that time period, because, like you said, we're losing these folks at 1,000 a day. And we're going to lose a chunk of history, and it's going to be American history and world history also, but mainly American history. And I think he's going to do an excellent job.
You know, not too long ago, I had a conversation with a man who's an Israeli, and he was making a very interesting contrast between 18-year-old boys or 18-year-old young men in America versus Israel. What's different about the Israeli young man versus the American young man? The American young man, your average 18-year-old today, let's just say he graduated from high school back in May, probably a college freshman or about that age, he's never had to grow up facing the specter of war. He never had to grow up with fear that a bomb might land on his front lawn or that his family members might be taken in a suicide bomb attack. That 18-year-old Israeli young man is expected to go into the armed services, is trained from young childhood with that expectation, physically, mentally, getting him ready. You know, that is a big difference. George W. Bush, I think, was, that's George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, the father of the current president, was, I believe, 17 years old when he signed up to be a Navy airman. He was fighting in the Pacific Theater in a fighter at age 17. Let me just ask 17-year-old young men today, can you imagine being in that situation by choice? He lied in order to sign up. The phone number is 877-893-8255. Back with your calls. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Jones and the soundtrack for Ken Burns' documentary, The War. And by the way, the soundtrack is very moving, and especially when that particular song sung by singer Norah Jones comes up, it's at one of those great moments when you see Americans dying, as I recall, at Guadalcanal, just trying to go ashore and facing incredible odds. The four cities, or the four towns, better said, that are the focus of the Ken Burns documentary, going back to the war and telling the story from the people from those towns in particular, are Luverne, Minnesota, Mobile, Alabama, Sacramento, California, and Waterbury, Connecticut. And some of the interesting things that came up, by the way, you just go back to a little town like Luverne, Minnesota. The 1939 high school class graduated 21 boys, 21 young men. 20 of them went on to serve in the armed services. Only one young man with an unfortunate heart condition stayed behind. In that one county that only had 10,683 residents, 1,065 served in the military. That's one out of 10. And of those, 32 were killed. One of the moving parts of the story, and as I recall, that is focused in Mobile, in particular, where this story is told. The young woman, who was then very young during the war and had a brother serving in the war, talked about what it meant all of a sudden to have those telegrams come back telling them that a loved one had died. And it was a boy down the street and one down on the corner. And before you knew it, all of a sudden, there was a sense that this was a war that was all too real. And yet America was mobilized to fight this war. One of the things I want to come back to is the moral clarity of World War II. And I want to suggest that it is very important to recognize that moral clarity. And secondly, it is very dangerous to assume that we will always have that same level of moral clarity when we find ourselves in a situation of world conflict. In World War II, you had an evil foe. That evil foe in the European theater was Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler, by the time America was in the war in 1941, was recognized worldwide for his ambitions to rule the world, as it were, and in particular, to subjugate nations, to be the king and ruler of Europe, to create Lebensraum, or living room, living space, for his Aryan race, centered in an idea of German supremacy. You go back to that whole idea of racial supremacy, you go back to the eugenics movement, you go back to the ideological underpinnings of the Nazi movement, you understand there was an evil that literally is unspeakable and yet has to be spoken. And then you get to the murder of 6 million European Jews, almost one out of three Jews on the planet, during the period of World War II, whose life was forfeited in the Holocaust. And you're looking at an unmitigated evil. Now, I want to go back to 1941. Not all of that was known, but enough of it was known to know that Hitler had to be defeated. Now, here is the great question. Why did the world sit back and let Hitler come to power? In other words, enough should have been known at the midpoint in the 1930s to know where this was headed. I think it's another sign to us that moral clarity sometimes takes a long time to sink in. And then you look at some of the conflict, the moral conflict of that war. I mean, after all, one of our allies was Joseph Stalin, who over the time of his tenure as the ruthless autocrat and dictator of the Soviet Union almost surely led to the forfeiture of more lives, the murder of more people, even than Adolf Hitler. But he was our ally during that war. Another morally complex part of the story. Military historians will say that it is almost impossible to imagine how we could have won that war without Russia bleeding as it did, losing far more people than any other nation, far more civilians and far more troops than any other nation, if it had not bled to such an extent and used up so much of Hitler's energy and resources. It's hard to imagine how the Allies would have won. It's very hard for us also to go back to World War II and recognize that, in one sense, American and Allied victory was assured, if nothing else, by the sheer size of the United States and by its economic power and by its access to materiel by which we could turn out thousands of fighters a month. We could continue to turn out ships. We could continue to turn out armaments. We could continue to turn out troops and guns. But that was not so clear at the beginning. America had, let's put it this way. It had an army, as Hitler was gaining power, that was smaller than that of most European nations and even smaller than that of some we would now call third world countries. We were unprepared. Moral clarity often comes later. Well, let's also fast forward. Let's fast forward to the Korean conflict and Vietnam. Let's fast forward to the war on terror. What is it we should be seeing as the mechanism of our moral evaluation of these wars? Well, we need to go back to the fact that we do not always have the kind of information, we do not always have the kind of context that America had in World War II, where we were willing to do without just about anything as a country and to send our own sons into battle because we knew that otherwise an even greater disaster would befall us. I want to go out on a limb here, and I want to say that I think a part of the reason that America was not so mobilized during the Korean conflict and was not so mobilized during the Vietnam War and sadly is not so mobilized during the current war on terror is because we do not sense that same danger. Now, it will be interesting to see, looking back, if we are given the privilege of looking back from some future point in history, it will be interesting to see if we will one day have to look back and see that we lacked a clarity that we should have seen, that we lacked a determination that we should have had, that we lacked a full mobilization that was called for at the time. It is very, very disheartening to me to have this discussion on the very day that the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, is given the privilege of addressing an academic setting at one of America's most prestigious universities. This is a man who has announced his own version of Mein Kampf. This is a man who has both the will and the means to do tremendous damage on the world scene. This is a man who leads a regime that is known to be fueling the war on terror. This is a man who, in a frighteningly similar way to Adolf Hitler, has announced his murderous intention upon the Jews. And he speaks today at Columbia University. And no doubt many of the people who saw him and welcome him on that campus today. We'll go home and watch the second installment of the Ken Burns documentary, The War Tonight. How in the world are they missing that connection? I just have to wonder. I'll be back with some final thoughts in just a moment to remind us of how Christians historically have learned to think about the morality of war. This is the Albert Mueller Program. Welcome back. You know, as Christians have tried to think through the question of war, we recognize that war is not something in which we can glory. In other words, there are great glorious stories of heroism and courage in war, but you take it from someone who's been there, as I have heard from so many who've been there. I've never been there myself. It's not something in which you can glory in itself. I think it was Robert E. Lee who made a statement one time saying that it's a good thing war is so horrible, otherwise we might love it too much. That is a sobering word. There is something within us that can love war for the wrong reason. That's one of the reasons why we can even glory in the wrong things about war. The Christian tradition has tried to understand how it is that a Christian should ever fight, or how a Christian conscience should inform the question of whether to fight. It has traditionally come down as what's called just war theory. And it has two parts. First of all, when a war itself is just, in other words, when a war would be justified. And then secondly, how a just war would have to be fought. Now, like everything else, this question has become much more complicated in our day. For instance, one of the main principles of just war theory is that every war that is just is a defensive war. And this whole process of thinking comes down to the fact that war has to be the least worst option. That kind of mangles the language, but it makes the point, the least worst option. When everything else has been tried, this is what remains. In other words, the only thing that will be worse than fighting this war is not fighting it. And we have come to the point in human history where that has so often been the case, and World War II is one of those very clear examples. If you want a textbook example of how just war theory is to work, there it is. Was the war justified? Of course it was. But the second part of just war theory is how the war must itself be fought. You know, one of the things that may draw criticism of Ken Burns' documentary is that he is at pains at times to talk about where Americans did the wrong thing, even in the course of fighting the right war. Now, some may quibble with this or that story, and some may even object that that material is there. I think it's important that it is there, lest we revel in war too much. We are sinners, and in a Genesis 3 world, there's no way that even those on the right side, fighting for the right reasons with the just cause, can do so without some complicity in evil. America and her allies did some things during the war that by the expanse and comparison of other wars would have been seen as wrong. For instance, the aerial bombardment of cities, as was conducted by the 8th Air Force. Every one of these decisions took place within a context. It's important for us to go back and say, we need to be honest about this war. We need to be honest about the fact that it had to be fought. We need to be honest about the fact that we sinners can never do even the right thing perfectly. But we need to look back with tremendous gratitude to a generation that was willing to put their lives on the line and to forfeit their lives by the thousands in order that we might have this conversation today. The heroes of those from a generation that fought in what we simply call these days the war. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation with my guest, Dr. Paige Patterson. I'll meet you then.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmohler.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmohler.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.